Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, so we had to work pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But don't you know,
yes indeed, we started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger, David Burns, and the Rivertown Kids. I am Harvey Wasserman. This is another hour of the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. I'm actually talking to you from the Burbank, California airport. I've got a nice connection here, and we are ready to rock and roll. We have a spectacular show today with my co-conspirator Bob Patrick is joining us, the Green Party candidate for Congress from my district in Central Ohio, to which I'm flying tonight. And we are deeply honored and gratified to have with us the wonderful Jill Stein. I think you're hearing the announcements in the background. My plane is not for a while. I timed this well. We are here with Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate for president. I introduced her to a wonderful gathering in Washington, D.C. a couple of weeks ago. She very graciously agreed to come on the show. Jill, are you with us?
You, Harvey, and with Bob. Great to be with you both.
All right, and what airport are you sitting in?
I actually just came out of the Logan airport, having flown in from the Houston airport, having flown in from the Colorado airport, having flown in from the Washington airport, and it gets harder to trace after that.
Yeah, well, I hope you're getting your frequent flyer miles. My daughter, when she was five, had the hello.
Can you hear me? Hello, hello?
Yes, I can.
Okay,
so I hope my daughter, when she was 5 years old, had the best line of all about flying. We flew from Columbus, Ohio to Pensacola, Florida, and as we landed, she turned to me and said, "Why are we at the airport again?" So I thought that was exactly right, actually. So, Jill Stein, you are the Green Party candidate for president. You fall in a great line of people, wonderful people, who have run for president for the Green Party. And we're going to go through the whole array. We've got the whole hour. And
awesome.
I want you to make your case. We will be joined, or are joined, by Bob Fitrakis, my longtime co-conspirator and the Green Party candidate for Congress in the, I think it's the 13th district now. They moved them around a bit. But Bob is running for Congress in my district. But you are the candidate for president. I heard you speak. You're extremely well-spoken, of course, as we would expect, and have tremendous takes on the issues. So let's start off with the thing that everybody's talking about now, which is why weren't you in the debate between Obama and Romney? We wanted you to get up there and say what's really happening. Instead, Obama seemed to be in a trance and missed from the country club with another round of golf. So tell us, what did you think of the debate, and what would you have done?
Great. I mean, it was a traumatic experience, I think, for people who actually sat through that debate and watched it. It was like being assaulted with, with the fantasy of the 1%, or being subjected to some seminar for CEOs or something on minutia of tax policy. It was just, it was really a pretty, it spoke volumes about what the priorities are and how much they care about you and me. You know, where were everyday people in that agenda? Where were people, peace, and the planet, and the climate, and our civil liberties, and the offshoring of our jobs, and the massive Wall Street bailouts, with the latest quantitative easing just having been announced, we're spending another $40 billion basically buying up bad bank debt again for the fourth time, and that didn't even make it into the discussion. They were too busy talking about really gibberish of tax code, and Romney was certainly changing his positions very rapidly in real time about whether he was or was not going to give tax breaks to the wealthy. Suddenly he was insisting that his $5 trillion tax break isn't going to happen, not a bit, that he'll be closing so many loopholes that still remain unnamed. So, you know, in summary, it was really, I think, pretty much a waste of time for people who watched it and survived the experience. We were actually doing an extended debate, what was called an extend the debate with Democracy Now, that provided a airtime for myself and Rocky Anderson to actually answer questions. They paused the broadcast to allow two other candidates to actually rebut and debunk the garbage that was being discussed by Obama and Romney. So it was quite satisfying to be able to do that. But I just want to make one more point, which is that, very briefly here, sort of an opening point. In every race that I've been in at the state level, in my home state in Massachusetts, we were always excluded at the outset of the debate, and we always managed to fight our way in for at least one of the major televised debates. And we are doing that now. We have not yet given up the cause here, and we encourage people to go to our website, jillstein.org, and you can click on the button that basically says, open up the debates, occupy the Commission on Presidential Debates, which is that corporate, that private corporation run by Democrats and Republicans whose job it is to basically shut down open small d Democratic discussion and debate through this farce of a debate. We are, you know, at this point, collecting signatures. Send it out. Send out the URL to your friends. Let's pile on as many signatures as we can, and then we're encouraging people to actually show up at the next debate if you can get to New York. The next debate is at Hofstra University, I believe, on the 16th of October, but you can find it on our website. So we consider this very much an active issue. We're not sitting this out on the sidelines.
No, not at all. And I like your phrase there that Mitt Romney was changing his positions in real time. I like that. That's very cool. So, of course, my favorite memory of the debates, and I'm looking at your jillstein.org website here. You have Sherry Hankala. Is that the correct pronunciation?
As your running mate? Hankala? Hankala, technically? Yeah.
Okay. And what is her ethnic origin?
It is mixed, actually, and her father is Native American,
okay,
and her mother is Finnish, Finland.
From Finland.
Yeah.
Well, of course, Ralph Nader, I was about to mention my favorite debate moment. Ralph Nader showed up for a debate in the audience in 2000, a debate between George W. Bush and Al Gore, and they arrested him for showing up in the audience. Astonishing. I mean, really, really, really amazing. And there's absolutely no reason why you should not be a part of these debates. It would totally change the whole tone of things. We might actually get, dare I say, at some content. Of course, there are other candidates as well. One is Gary Johnson. I don't know if you've run into him at all.
We had a small debate. We had a mini debate on NPR over the weekend on Weekend Edition.
Well, and Gary Johnson, of course, he's a former governor of New Mexico.
That's right.
And he advocates legal marijuana, among other things. But certainly doesn't take the positions you take. So, and you're listed here as the first Jewish presidential contender, and you will welcome the Russell Tribunal findings on Palestine. I'm going to spill a little known fact. Ralph Nader's running mate was Winona LaDuke, and of course Winona is well known as a Native American activist from the Anishinaabe tribe in northern Minnesota. But I hope she'll forgive me for spilling this secret, but Winona LaDuke's mother is actually Jewish. So we have you are the, you're certainly the first Jewish candidate to top a ticket, but we did have a Jewish Native American running for vice president with Ralph Nader. And let's address an issue here that's before it slips my mind, that continues to deeply disturb me, which is after the 2000 election, which was blatantly stolen by the Republican Party with Jeb Bush, the brother of the president or the candidate for president as governor of Florida, and his secretary of state there, Harris, they clearly stole that election. And there was absolutely no doubt about it. And Bob Fitzgerald is on the line with me, with you also, the Green Party candidate for Congress in Central Ohio, did a lot of the breakthrough reporting on that. But for the next 4 years, the Democrats and the supporters of Al Gore screamed and yelled at Ralph Nader for daring to run for president and for allegedly taking away the votes from Al Gore that would have put him in the White House, instead putting George W. Bush. Bob Fitzgerald is on with us. Bob, can you tell us what you found about Ralph's candidacy and what impact it did or did not have on the presidential election in 2000?
Well, you know, I mean, it had virtually none. I mean, if you allowed Greg Palast's famous reporting, if you allow them, the Republicans, to essentially eliminate 92,000 American citizens, which the number grew to because they had a same or similar name or the same date of birth of a felon in another state, Texas. Mm. And you did nothing to complain about that. It's hardly Ralph Nader's fault. You've got all sorts of bad counting results. You know, 10,000 votes that shouldn't have went to Buchanan because the Democrats weren't smart enough to look at the design of a confusing butterfly ballot. The key point on why Gore lost, despite, you know, blatant disenfranchisement by Catherine Harris, the Secretary of State there, as well as the bad ballots design, of course, was the fact that Al Gore was not principled. Had he simply called for a recount of the entire state of Florida, which is what the law allowed, instead of four hand-picked counties, he would have won the vote.
Mm. Yeah. Wow. It's amazing in retrospect.
And also, he didn't win his own state, Harvey. I mean, one of the few presidential contenders that couldn't win his own state.
Right.
And can I
right.
add to that?
Please.
If you add to that, sure. then, and hi, Bob. Welcome. Good to hear you again, if not see you.
Good.
If you add to that, the exit polls done by CNN and other news organizations documented where Nader's votes came from. They came equally from Democrats and Republicans, so he didn't draw any more from Gore than he did from Bush, and add to that, the vast majority of his votes actually came from Ross Perot voters who mm-hmm. otherwise had no one to vote for and otherwise would not have come out to vote. So it's absolutely a fallacy to start with that Nader's votes drew away from Al Gore. They did not. They came from people who otherwise wouldn't have voted.
Okay, so, Jill Stein, I'm sure you're asked ad nauseum, and so we'll get this out of the way. What do you tell people who say, well, you're running, you're a spoiler, you're just going to take votes away from Obama, and if Mitt Romney wins, you'll be responsible?
Well, first, let me just say that it has become really fun to answer this question because people are so agonized, really, about the loss of their jobs and, you know, the skyrocketing costs of health care, their homes are under threat, you know, the expanding war, attack on our civil liberties, you know, the skyrocketing cost of higher education. The people are pretty, there are a lot of unhappy campers out there. So when I find when people ask this question, it's often because they're really struggling themselves to try to get out from under this stranglehold, this public relations hype that is basically intended to silence opposition, you know, to silence opposition parties. So I find it actually really interesting when people ask the question because it's often because they're trying to work their way through it. And just to give you a quick example, doing National Public Radio live on the air in Oregon, And it was a half-hour show. I had 3 minutes to do the overview, did it. They opened up the phones. And the first caller said, I'm a lifelong Democrat, and I just want to say how good it is to finally hear the Democratic Party agenda in this race. And then the host interrupted him and said, well, wait a minute. You told the call screener you were going to accuse her of taking votes away from Obama. And he replied, well, I was going to accuse her of that until I heard what she had to say, and boy, did she win my vote. So,
well,
you know,
fantastic.
Up front, so, I just want to point out how people are, you know, they're quick to move. But then beyond that, you know, if they don't, we point out just what the track record of this politics of fear has been, that essentially it has caused a whole lot of political silence, and silence has not exactly been an effective strategy over the past 10 years to look at where we've gone. And in fact, this politics of fear that tells you to be quiet and go along to get along and do the lesser evil, that politics of fear has actually delivered all those things we were afraid of and all those reasons we were supposed to be quiet, so we wouldn't get, by voting our values, we wouldn't get, you know, the worst evil that would expand the war, that would offshore more jobs, that would increase these free trade agreements, who would attack immigrant rights and our civil liberties and expand the Wall Street bailouts. You know, that whole litany of things you needed to silence yourself in order to avoid, we've gotten all of them by the droves because we allowed ourselves to be silenced. And then the next point, if I get to make it, is to point out to people how, in fact, history shows exactly the opposite, that it's by standing up with social movements on the ground that fight for the abolition of slavery, for the right to organize unions, for 40-hour work week, for women's right to vote. It's by having a social movement on the ground together with an independent political party, the labor, the progressive, the socialist, etc. By having those independent parties, you actually drive that agenda forward. So whether you win the office or you just win the day, this is actually what real social and economic progress has always depended on. So it's not just okay to vote for a third party. It's absolutely life-saving, job-saving, and planet-saving.
Very good. Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate for president, on the Green Power, Soarotopia Green Power and Wellness Show here, live from the Burbank Airport. Jill is in Boston, and Bob is in Columbus, Ohio. Bob Fitzakis. Bob, as the Green Party candidate for Congress, I'm sure people are telling you that you're just taking votes away from the Democratic candidate. What do you tell them?
Well, you know, if they want my votes, let them actually work for them for talking in a way that's progressive enough to get the votes. You know, if they had enough guts as Eisenhower did, you know, look, quite frankly, they're not as good as Eisenhower Republicans of the 1950s, right? If they don't want to tax the 1% he did at 91%. Then they don't deserve my votes. Is that, you know, they want us to compete in the middle makes no sense. For example, for about $592 billion, you could literally employ every single, 23 million workers that are unemployed in the U.S., and you could do it at rates of $21 an hour for skilled workers, $18 for semi-skilled, and $15 for unskilled. You know, that's less money than both of the bank bailouts and stimulus, and it's far less than the untold trillions that the Federal Reserve used to, in fact, bail out, you know, the banks that were to blame. So, the fact that Jill has inspired a Green New Deal program, which I'm running on with her, and that we could actually put people to work doing the things that you so love, investing in and manufacturing renewables in the United States, putting, you know, those shingles on virtually every roof with embedded, solar cells. That's not my problem. If my congressional candidate in this district wants that program and wants my votes, let her come out for a Green New Deal.
Absolutely. Okay, we're with Bob Fitzakis, a Green Party candidate for Congress in Central Ohio. Jill Stein, the presidential Green Party candidate. Jill,
Give us your basic economic program, if you will, the Green New Deal. What does that mean, and how do you differ from Barack Obama and Mitt Romney?
Great. We only have an hour here, so. Yeah. Okay. So, basically, Bob sort of got to the heart of it. This is an emergency program to put people back to work. 25 million jobs, end unemployment, while we jumpstart the green economy for the future. And that, in turn, means that we can put a halt to climate change and make wars for oil obsolete. The Green New Deal, as Bob said, it would cost less than the cost of the first stimulus package, and it's an investment because it returns very quickly by jumpstarting the economy and returning revenues back into our coffers. It creates private sector jobs by providing grants and startup money and zero-interest loans that the banks will not provide, as well as providing those same funds and support for worker cooperatives so we can diversify the economy. And it also provides public works and public services, public sector jobs, to get those jobs going quickly, as we did during the New Deal. And the program provides national funding at the community level. So it's not a cookie-cutter top-down program, though there would be some regional initiatives, certainly, in programs that would require them. But it prioritizes community-based jobs and allows communities to make those decisions as to what kinds of jobs they need. And so this includes green sector jobs in clean renewable energy, conservation, efficiency, as well as in the green food economy for sustainable, organic local agriculture, public transportation, including active transit, so you can bike and walk to work or to transit hubs or to school without taking your life in your hands. And then it also jumpstarts social jobs that meet our needs socially, like hiring back the teachers, after school, daycare, affordable housing, drug abuse prevention, rehabilitation, things like that. So it's a broad spectrum of jobs, communities decide, and it gets the money into the hands of working people and into the communities to get the economy going at the same time that it, you know, puts an end to the climate crisis, ends our need for these wars for oil, this supposed need for wars for oil, and at the same time creates a real infrastructure for health, because what your mother always told you about, you know, getting exercise and eating your fresh fruits and vegetables, you know, that's preventing pollution, so not poisoning yourself. Those three things together could vastly decompress the expenditures we're now spending on what's not a health care system but a sick care system. 75% of those dollars spent on the sick care system, and it's over $2 trillion a year if you add up private and public costs. 75% of those costs are being spent on diseases that, chronic diseases that could be prevented at a tiny fraction of the cost. Preventing them is what the Green New Deal is about, because what's good for the climate and the planet and the economy also turns out to be good for your health. So it's a win-win all around.
We like that. We're talking to Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate for president, talking to us from Boston, Massachusetts. We're on with Bob Patricus, a Green Party candidate for Congress in Central Ohio, and my longtime co-conspirator on election theft, among other things. We've just published our fifth, count them, five books. This one's an e-book, Will the GOP Steal America's 2012 Election? Bob, are you concerned about the Green Party getting a fair vote count? I know when I introduced Jill in Washington, D.C., I told the story that I got from you, actually, that Eugene V. Debs, the great socialist candidate for president in 1904, 08, 1912, and 1920, took the year off in 1960 and ran for Congress in his hometown of Terre Haute, and the official vote count showed him getting zero votes. How do we know that the Green, that when you run for Congress and when Jill runs for president, that we're going to get an actual fair tabulation of how many votes go to the Green Party?
Well, I mean, you ultimately don't, in the sense that these machines are really push and pray machines. There's a few ways to vote on paper or with an absentee ballot, depending on what county you're in. But what I'm more concerned about, Harvey, is the story that that I co-wrote in the Free Press, that people from Bain Company, right, the company that worked with Bain Capital, you know, you set up the company, the managing company, as well as the investment company, in July 2011 decided to, three of its former key officers decided to go and form a new company. Three of the five there bought up Hart Intercivic. So they'll be counting the votes on their machines in Hamilton County, the home of Cincinnati, the second largest metro area in Ohio. And I was watching the Today Show today, and they're pushing the line. How Hamilton County goes, so will go Ohio. So I'm absolutely opposed, along with Jimmy Carter, I might add, to non-transparency in elections. Carter said that he doesn't monitor U.S. elections because they don't meet minimum standards for transparency.
Jill Stein, does the Green Party, does your candidacy have anything to say about electronic voting machines and where we should go with the vote count?
Sure. I mean, we call for reliable voting technology, which means basically hand-counted paper ballots, and we badly need to get there as soon as we possibly can. And, you know, I think it's... you know, it is really worrisome and disturbing, as Bob says, that, you know, it is kind of vote on electronic machines and keep your fingers crossed. You know, I think this is an issue that we just have to keep fighting and have to keep, you know, working to retire the electronic voting machines and have truly accountable, integrity voting systems.
Well, that's good. Bob Patricus and I have written a number of pieces advocating that we get rid of all voting machines as soon as possible, and we certainly agree with your position that there should be only hand-counted paper ballots printed on recycled paper, hemp if preferable, so they can be smoked at the end, and then that we have a four-day weekend, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, where everybody can vote, Tuesday being a national holiday, where the students, high school and college students of the country can work the polls and count the ballots. We also, of course, and I know the Green Party stands with this, want a reversal of the Citizens United decision so that we can get money out of politics. Corporations are not people. This is the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. We're on with the wonderful Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate for president, and with my co-conspirator for so many years, Bob Patricus, co-author with me of Will the GOP Steal America's 2012 Election, the ebook, which is available at freepress.org. We will take a break in a minute here. When we come back, we want to talk to Jill Stein and to Bob Patricus about foreign policy. We've heard about the Green New Deal, which is essentially the domestic economic policy of the Green Party of the United States and of Bob, both Jill and Bob's candidacies. One of the great disappointments, of course, if not a surprise, is Barack Obama's attack on Afghanistan. We will talk about that in just a minute.
Flooding suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam, road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia. It's time to get a better plan. Solartopia is home sweet home.
All right, we are back here in Solartopia. This is Harvey Wasserman. We have the Green Power and Wellness Show going on here with Jill Stein, the wonderful candidate for president, the Green Party candidate for president, and Bob Patricus. We have talked in the first hour a bit about the Solartopian economic program, the Green New Deal being put forth by the Green Party, by Jill Stein and her running mate, and Bob Patricus, the candidate for Congress. And Bob, what's the district now? Is it the 13th district in Central Ohio?
No, actually, it's the third district, and it really bespeaks the problem of the existing two-party system. Essentially, the Black Caucus cut a deal with the Republicans to do away with Kucinich's seat in exchange for a dense-packed, weird and very strange gerrymandered seat in Columbus, where it kind of looks like Jughead from the old comics. if you look at it sideways, with a little thin neck and little, you know, hands that go around, because they were trying to gather up all of the Democrats in the suburbs and leave the Republican area to Republican candidates.
Yeah, well, I just actually recently, I have a friend actually named Jerry Mander, who a great activist, a wonderful guy, actually gave me the grant to write Solartopia. And but I just learned the root of the word gerrymander for your edification. I'm sure you guys know, but the word gerrymander came way back in the 1780s, 1790s. There was a politician, his name was Elbridge Gerry. I can't remember his first name, but it was G-E-R-R-Y was his last name. And he started drawing these districts like we have today. And someone noted that it looked like one of the districts he drew looked like a salamander. And it became known as a gerrymander. So there you go. There's the root of the term gerrymander. I think he was a Massachusetts politician, Jill. Of course, you would never do such a thing as draw a district like that to help out the Green Party. But
yeah,
you would. You would advocate a sane foreign policy. So we talked the first hour about your Solartopian energy policies, the Green New Deal. Let's hear now from you, Jill Stein, please, Green Party candidate for president. And by the way, just for those of you listening in who tuned in late, I am speaking to you from the Burbank Airport. So if you hear some people yelling in the background, that's the origin of that background noise. You're in a saner place, Jill. If you will tell us, please, now, what is your foreign policy?
Great. And just before I dive into that, I want to mention it's sort of divine justice now that the great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson, I guess, of this guy, Jerry, who started the gerrymandering, is now a member of the Green Party in Boston. Yeah, and he actually told me this story a couple months ago about his relative.
I was accurate. I didn't just make that up.
It really is true, yes. And
okay.
And he lives to work to fix it. So things come around, you know.
Wonderful. If you can ascertain his ancestors' first name, that would be good. I think it was Eldridge, but I may be wrong.
I'll find out. Okay. I'll let you know. But
okay,
on the foreign policy realm, you know, we have a pretty simple fix for foreign policy, and that is to abandon a foreign policy based on brute military force and the procurement of oil and scarce resources, and instead to have a foreign policy based on international law and human rights. This is sort of the flip side of the Green New Deal, because it truly makes us energy independent, so we no longer have the excuse or the justification for conducting wars for oil. Now, of course, the pressure, you know, could still be there to expand the capitalist markets, of course, and that's equally a driver in the foreign policy. But we're saying it's time to cast all of that aside and, you know, embrace the world of diplomacy, international law, and human rights. So that means bring the troops home from Afghanistan. None of this commitment until the year, 2024, something like that, where Obama has committed us to continue defending the current government of Afghanistan, even though our soldiers are being shot up by Afghani soldiers who perceive our soldiers as the enemy. You know, this is a foreign policy that's not working. We're saying an end to the drone wars, which have expanded this bombing campaign, which the president, I might add, began on day 3 in office, where he undertook this intensified bombing campaign in Pakistan. And the blowback now is that some 70% of Pakistanis identify the United States as the real enemy, not some terrorist organization. It's the United States that they consider the problem. And this is no surprise when you have a foreign policy based on, you know, the barrel of a gun and the bomb out of a drone. In Iran, you know, we're saying the problem, you know, is nuclear weapons, period, not, and as well as nuclear power, which always creates the, you know, the opening for the creation of nuclear weapons, and that the real solution to the you know, the potential that that Iran may acquire a nuclear weapon is to actually create a nuclear-free Middle East. And the real solution, of course, is a nuclear-free world, because preventing the spread of nuclear weapons, so-called non-proliferation of nuclear weapons, depends fundamentally on achieving nuclear disarmament. The only way to stop new nations from claiming the bomb is to say, well, we're going to get rid of it too. So that's basically where we need to go. Unfortunately, we've seen Obama very much like, you know, strike a posture very much like Romney, although Obama says it much nicer and in a far less aggressive way, but the basics are basically still there, that Obama is expanding these wars. He's calling for a whole new generation of nuclear weapons and new weapon delivery systems, with some $600 billion in renovations of power of nuclear weapon creation, new nuclear-armed missiles, subs, and strategic bombers. He's called for a whole, you know, and has actually beginning this development of new bases to surround China, so as to, you know, basically creating a whole new Cold War here. This is not the way forward, and, you know, this is a incredible squandering of our precious tax dollars, $1 trillion every year in this bloated military-industrial security complex that is not making us more secure. We need to scale back to the military expenditures of year 2000 will still be three times the size of the next biggest spender, and to create a foreign policy based on real negotiations, the rule of law, and this is the way that we move forward, not through these sort of macho, hyper-militarist engagements. And I might include arming the world, which is what our military-industrial complex is doing right now, having tripled its exports to where the U.S. weapons industry is now the war profiteer of the world, pouring arms into virtually every ethnic, national, military, religious conflict around the world and exploding them. What would be manageable small-scale conflicts are now becoming major international conflicts because, it's weapon sales fundamentally. So this needs to be fixed. It can be fixed. It's not rocket science. It's all about having a government that's really responsive to our needs, not the needs of the weapons industry, the nuclear power industry, and so on. This is eminently fixable.
Sounds good to me. Bob Fitrakis, you wrote a major piece on Libya, and of course, as a Green Party candidate for Congress, you have a foreign policy, which I assume is pretty much in sync with Jill Stein's. What would you have to add here?
Well, just, and I guess it's not ironic if it's so easy to predict, right? If you violate international law and use NATO, which was set up as a defensive alliance in the Cold War, to intervene in Libya and really support the rebels in Benghazi who were tied to al-Qaeda, it should then come as no shock. Instead of going in and trying to negotiate some sort of settlement or have an autonomous region, essentially we went in and systematically destroyed the army of, in this case, Qaddafi, unleashed forces, Islamic fundamental and al-Qaeda forces in Benghazi, who then predictably turn around and kill our ambassador. But all this was predictable. You've now taken a state that was a nation state, and you've turned it into 200 minimum ruling militias, including an autonomous area of the West, and arch enemies of the United States. As I've said before, essentially this makes the world much more unsafe, and, justifies military spending that wouldn't have been needed. Qaddafi was not a threat to the United States or to the West.
But it did generate or help generate quite a few profits for the war industry that whose armaments were used to go in there and overthrow him. Joe Stein, the old Socialist Party platform called for the abolition of war. Do you see when you get the Nobel Prize? you know, as far as I'm concerned, by the way, and that well, there are a few things about Obama that really get me going. I would say the number one, well, in addition to the fact that he's turned into a narc, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but his Nobel Prize acceptance speech, I believe, was probably the first pro-war speech ever given with the acceptance of the Nobel Prize. When you and Bob jointly get the Nobel Prize for ending war here in the United States, what would you have to say about war and what Obama has done?
Well, you know, Obama's policies have certainly been an extension of extremely misguided and destructive war policies of the United States for quite some time. And as you point out, it's especially painful because Obama had created these expectations that he was going to be the peace president, although if you paid close attention, he was really talking about substituting one war for the other. That is, you know, surging into Afghanistan instead of Iraq. He really never pretended to be a real peace president if you looked behind, you know, his headlines. And the way that he has expanded the drone wars, starting from day three, as I pointed out earlier, prior to there being any pressure from Republicans. There were no Republicans in the room. He had both houses of Congress. There was no need to adopt that, you know, that brute force posture. You know, he's sort of proving himself to be the tough guy, you know, maybe because he didn't serve in the military or whatever, but, you know, it's just part of an extension of this Bush mentality about being the tough guy, not just the policeman of the world, but far more than that, you know, sort of the prison guard of the world. It's, you know, it's really been a disaster. And as we're seeing now with, you know, the not only the killing of the U.S. ambassador in Libya, but the demonstrations against U.S. embassies all throughout the Middle East, and the fact that we cannot turn over the war effort. You know, U.S. soldiers were supposed to be training Afghani soldiers so that we could exit gracefully from Iraq, but somehow those training programs are kind of on hold right now because it's too dangerous to try to, you know, train the Afghanis. It's such a tragic picture of how peace is not created through the barrel of a gun. And, you know, we will, you know, a green administration, if we turn the White House into a greenhouse, you know, we will certainly be working to establish a Department of Peace, not a Department of War, a true Department of Defense, not a Department of Offense, which is unfortunately what our Defense Department has become.
Yes, since let's segue because we're running actually kind of low on time here. Well, I'm talking with Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate for President of the United States, and Bob Fitrakis, the Green Party candidate for Congress in the 3rd District in Central Ohio, U.S. Congress. Jill, you talked about turning the White House into a greenhouse. I assume that includes the hydroponic cultivation of marijuana. Can you talk about the drug policy and, you know, the other war that the people say that the longest war the United States has been involved in is Afghanistan. It's actually not true. It's the drug war that is the longest war in U.S. history. Mm-hmm. What would the Green Party, what would your presidency do about the drug war?
We would call it to a halt because it's a racist and failed policy. It has doubled the size of our jails in the last 15 years, filling them largely with nonviolent recreational users of a substance which is far less dangerous than tobacco and alcohol. So
that would be cannabis, marijuana.
Exactly, that's right. And in fact, we would, on day one, a president, if she wanted, could instruct the Drug Enforcement Agency to do a really radical thing, and that is to use science in determining what substances would be considered listed and scheduled substances and therefore made illegal. because if science was used, there's actually no scientific reason to be treating marijuana and hemp, for that matter, as scheduled substances, because they are dangerous, in fact, because they're illegal. They're not illegal for being dangerous drugs. They are not dangerous drugs. So we would, by using science, we can begin to call a halt to the war on drugs immediately, and we can transition to a policy of treating where substance abuse and addiction exist. They should be treated as mental health problems and public health problems, not as criminal acts. To criminalize this problem is to truly create a real devastating social problem and economic problem, and to make former convicts essentially to turn them into criminals, because when you get out of jail, you can't find housing, you can't get a break on your tuition to go to college. I mean, they're just, and you can't get a job too for being an ex convict. So, you know, we're devastating lives and communities. I think it's one out of every four African Americans that are basically facing jail, you know, over the course of a lifetime. It's just, it has a staggering impact on people. It's entirely destructive. And we could take, for the money it costs, some $40,000, some states more, $40,000 a year that it costs to incarcerate someone, you know, we could completely rehabilitate them, put them through college, and put them on the road to productive, you know, and healthy community life and citizenship. And this is the direction we will take.
The Green Party will take. That's Joe Stein, Green Party candidate for president. Bob Petraeus, Green Party candidate for Congress from the third district in Central Ohio. What can you add anything to the to this elucidation of the Green Party program for the ending the drug war?
Well, again, it's, if you've got 4% of the world's population, you're locking up nearly a quarter of the people on the planet, mm-hmm. and your per capita lockup rate is, you know, in the mid-700s, and the closest Western industrial democracy is Spain with about 150 per capita, is that, you know, our rates are 4 and 5 times any other democracy. But I think not only important with the drug war, but also the use of hemp itself. Mm-hmm. Even more absurd is, of course, outlawing hemp, which is really a wonder product you can't mm-hmm. get high off of. It's sort of outlawing corn because somebody makes corn mash.
Yeah, well, mm-hmm. we will point out, of course, I have my own book called Passions of the Pot-Smoking Patriots, written by Thomas Paine on the pseudonym, in which we point out that both George Washington and Thomas Jefferson were avid hemp raisers. Not only did they raise it, but they wrote about it. They sang the praises of hemp. If you walked into the Constitutional Convention in 1787 in Philadelphia and told the founders that hemp, in this great country they were founding, hemp would be illegal, they would laugh you out of the room. You mentioned, Jill, the power of hemp as an industrial product. Do you want to elucidate on that, elaborate on that a little more? Have you followed that closely? Because it has a huge constituency for legalizing hemp.
Yeah, and we're very strongly supportive of that, again, as an urgent measure that could be accomplished on day one of a presidency. I mean, Obama could do it right now if he wanted, and we would certainly do it as an urgent priority. And it could be accomplished simply by an executive instructions to the DEA to use science. That would certainly bring hemp off the list immediately. And hemp is a wonderful resource, as Bob was saying, and you were saying as well, Harvey, that hemp has so many applications. It is a source of very important nutrients. It's a source, it's a food source. It is a source of food and fiber and manufacturing. Henry Ford constructed a car out of it. Mercedes-Benz uses hemp for alloy to make some of the paneling and some of the parts of the car. There are just so many manufacturing uses, and then there's also the potential use as a biofuel as well, where hemp can be grown in agricultural areas that cannot produce food. It's a very hardy plant, and it does not require this nearly as much, and perhaps none at all, fertilizer, and same thing for water requirements. So it's a wonderful crop. It's very important that people be able to produce it, small farmers, backyard growers. It needs to be liberated as an economic tool for developing local economies.
Excellent, yes. And of course, one of the promises that Barack Obama made that he broke was that he would not send federal agents to arrest people in the states where marijuana has been legalized for medical use. And we have three states now with ballot initiatives in Washington, Oregon, and Colorado to make marijuana actually legal for people over the age of 21 and older. Very, very interesting. It's actually expected that the, and I assume the Green Party has endorsed these, it's expected the one in Washington is looking pretty good. The Washington state, that it will win, and I assume then the U.S. military will attack with drones and try and wipe out all marijuana dealers. But it's good to hear we have a major party, the Green Party, that's backing this. Bob, what's your position on hemp in Central Ohio, quickly?
Oh, well, I'm going to the Farm Bureau and making that pitch. We find farmers are really receptive to hemp. They think they could grow it easy because it grows like a weed.
Mm-hmm. It is weed, as a matter of fact. Of course, we all know if you throw it in the ground in the spring, a couple of seeds, you don't have to do anything. But in the fall, you get a 10-foot hemp plant and a 6-foot federal agent. We are trying to eliminate the federal agent here. We have been talking this hour with Jill Stein, Green Party candidate for President of the United States, speaking us from Massachusetts. Bob Fitrakis, Green Party candidate for Congress from the 3rd District of Central Ohio. I have been with you from the Burbank Airport, which explains the background noise you've been hearing, but it's been a great show with both of you. Jill, what is your plan to win the presidency? What are you doing next, and how, in general, do you feel the campaign has been going?
The campaign is just going like a wildfire, and it's really exciting. We've been tied up in knots getting on the ballot by design. They, you know, keep you very busy running in place just to get ballot status, and we succeeded. We made history. We're on the ballot in 85% for 85% of voters. We made history in making matching funds for the first time for the Green Party, running an actual party member. And what we're calling for right now is, number one, let's open up the debates. Go to our website, jillstein.org, and join the petition, which is to occupy the Commission on Presidential Debates. If you sign it and send the URL out to your networks, we hope to create an unstoppable force and to actually show up at the next debate in New York, which I believe is at Hofstra University on the 16th, but the date is on our website. But equally important,
Take Ralph Nader with you and sit in the audience and see if they arrest both of you.
That's a great idea. I'll invite him. But the last point I wanted to make real quick was that, consider this fact. I mean, two facts. One is that 90 million people are not going to vote. That's 90 million eligible voters, twice as many as the number that will vote for Obama, twice as many as the number that will vote for Bush. If democracy had anything to do with it, we've already won this election. But the problem is getting the word out. We have enormous power to do that. Consider that 36 million students who are good at Facebook and social media, 36 million students and recent grads are indentured servants. They have nowhere to go. They turned politics on its head in Tunisia and in Egypt. It took them about 3 weeks. We've got 4 weeks before the election. You know, get the word out. Go to the website. Get on Twitter and Facebook and use the newsletter to spread to your email networks. If we go viral, we can turn politics on its head in this election and turn this breaking point we face into the tipping point we need to take back our democracy and the peaceful, just, green future we deserve. Like Alice Walker said, biggest way people give up power is by not knowing we have it to start with. We do have it. We're the ones we've been waiting for. Let's stand up and use it.
All right, Bob Fakakis, it's been a pleasure being with you, the Green Party candidate for president in the 3rd Congressional District in Central Ohio. Jill Stein, the presidential candidate for the Green Party nationwide. Jill, you're on the ballot in virtually every state in the country now, is that right?
Well, we're on for 85% of voters. It's actually 38
okay.
states, but it's all the big states and most of the others. So, you know, you'll be on the ballot. Just check it. Most of the time
Thank
we're there.
Thank you so much. We'll send you the URL of the show, post it at your website, bobatreepress.org. Thank you much. It's been a great Green Power Wellness show. Next week, we'll be talking about ballot integrity once again and the struggle to save our democracy. See you next
Thank
week.
You.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Thanks, Bob. Take care.
And so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging.